The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for tuning in this week. Please don't forget to rate, review, and follow the show. And with that, let's get into the case. Phyllis Ward was 74 years old at the time of her murder in 2012. Phyllis was born in Gary, Indiana, and much of her childhood was spent moving around the country, depending on where her dad's Air Force assignment brought the family. Eventually, he was stationed in Germany, so Phyllis graduated high school in Frankfurt, Germany. After high school, Phyllis married a man somewhere in Europe, but the marriage ended in divorce after 2 years. When Phyllis was in her late 20s in 1965, she married a different man named Charles, and they went on to have 3 children. And to my knowledge, she was back in the United States by that point. They had 2 sons and 1 daughter, Jeffrey, Spence, and Jennifer, in that order. Phyllis's children have described her as a devoted and wonderful mother who did everything for her children. But her marriage to Charles, their father, came to an end after 15 years in 1980. After the divorce, Phyllis really examined her life, questioning what would be her next best step, and ultimately decided to return to college and work toward her master's degree in education from Boise State University in Idaho. Phyllis was a memorable teacher. When you look up this case online, it doesn't take long to find comments from former students remarking how Phyllis was their favorite teacher. And some even shared little anecdotes about their time as a student in her class. So for these people to come forward as adults after all these years to make comments like this, it's clear that Phyllis left a lasting impression on her students. When Phyllis was working as a teacher, her neighbors introduced her to her future and final husband, Jack, whom she married in 1986. They had a great marriage by all accounts, and it appeared they would spend the rest of their lives together. However, their marriage was cut short when Jack suddenly died after 17 years of marriage in 2003. The loss was difficult for Phyllis, though she kept busy. Retired from teaching, Phyllis spent much of her time with family and friends while pursuing numerous hobbies. She was known as an avid gardener, an excellent cook, and a skilled seamstress. Phyllis also loved crafting, often popping a classic movie on the TV when working on her crafts. And she remained remarkably active despite her age. Shortly before her death, she had even begun taking ballroom dancing classes. But most of all, Phyllis had a passion for antiquing. In fact, her daughter, Jennifer, noted that if there were an item or an antique that could be collected, Phyllis likely had it in her collection. Phyllis's son, Jeff, said his mom took great pride in her home. Her antiques and belongings became a part of her identity over time. And normally you might think that someone's possessions shouldn't necessarily be part of their identity, but with Phyllis, it was different. She really cared for each piece. It's not like she was collecting items produced for mass consumption. I imagine each antique had its own story. I was able to look at Phyllis's house on Google Street View before she was murdered, so when she was still living there, and it was the cutest home. The landscape looked amazing. So all of this information about how she cared for her home, her belongings, her garden, all of that was evidence even just by the exterior. Phyllis lived on the Boise Bench, an area comprising 8 neighborhoods just up the hill from downtown. It gets its name because it's at a higher elevation compared to the lower sections of Boise. Part of the attraction of the bench, as many locals call it, is the diversity of its homes. There are many different styles of homes with character and charm. So when I learned all of this, I thought Phyllis was in the perfect place based on what we know about her.
So this really has nothing to do with the case, but you've said it a handful of times and you always do extremely thorough research, but I'm just wondering about the pronunciation of Boise. I always say Boise, but I hear you saying Boise.
Yeah, I had to research this because I've heard that the pronunciation is debated. And from what I found, most locals, I think, pronounce it as Boise, whereas a lot of other people pronounce it as Boise if they're not from the area. So I felt like it would be more appropriate to use the pronunciation that the people who actually live there use. So that's why, yeah, I'm saying Boise. I don't know that Boise is considered wrong, but I just think it makes sense to use the pronunciation that a lot of people who live there use.
Okay. Yeah, I never knew that. That makes sense.
If we have any listeners who are from that area, then definitely let us know how you pronounce it. But Phyllis felt safe in her community and frequently would leave doors open, allowing her to easily move between her garden and the inside of her home. Phyllis's youngest son, Spence, repeatedly offered to install a home security system for her, and each time Phyllis hesitated. As he explained, she was decidedly anti-technology, and because I know where this case goes, I'm sure that's hard to think about now. I don't think a home security system would have stopped her murder, but if she had the system, maybe emergency services could have arrived sooner, or if there were cameras, they could have assisted in the investigation. Phyllis spent the weekend before her murder doing what she loved. On Saturday, July 21st, 2012, she and her son Spence, who also loved antiquing, visited an estate sale in a neighboring city. Phyllis purchased several items, including a wooden ship, a cabinet, a brass bowl, and books, among other items. After the estate sale, Phyllis called her daughter Jennifer. Phyllis wanted to know if Jennifer was interested in some books at the sale. Phyllis was asking about the books because she planned to return to the estate sale the next day, Sunday, but Jennifer turned down her mom's offer to pick up the books for her and said she would talk to her later. Phyllis and Spence returned to the estate sale the next day, Sunday, July 22nd, as planned. Afterward, they ate lunch at a local Applebee's, then returned to Phyllis's house where they spent time together until around 3 p.m. when Spence left. Phyllis didn't leave the house again after that, as far as we know, or spend time with anyone else. So Spence was the last person to see his mom alive other than her killer. Spence told the Idaho Statesman that when he reflects on that weekend, it was one of the best times they had shared in a long time. So he definitely cherishes that time spent together. The next day, around 7 a.m., as some of Phyllis's neighbors began their day, they noticed smoke billowing from her home. To be clear, the home from the outside was not visibly on fire, but they did see smoke coming from the house, probably from various openings or gaps, and that led them to believe there was a fire inside her home. So they called 911 to report the situation. When the first responders arrived and entered Phyllis's home, they found Phyllis deceased in her bedroom, situated in a back corner of the home. Phyllis was badly burned, although the status of the fire when they arrived is a bit unclear. It sounded as though the fire had burned out by that point and had already done its damage. But again, it's not entirely clear.
Were the firefighters able to determine where the fire started?
Probably, but that hasn't been reported on. I can tell you there was fire and heat damage throughout her house, but the worst of it was concentrated in her bedroom. So you would think that's where the fire started, the same place she was found.
Okay, so likely not an accident in the kitchen.
No, but I will tell you, her family thought it was an accident initially. One of the neighbors had Phyllis's daughter Jennifer's phone number. So that person called Jennifer and let her know about the fire. Many people close to Phyllis initially thought she had fallen asleep while smoking a cigarette in bed, leading to this tragic accident. Although she had given up cigarettes about 6 months before her death, she had been a smoker for so long that her family considered this the most likely scenario. According to the Idaho Statesman, her daughter couldn't imagine any other conclusion. Murder was not on their minds at all.
Yeah, I'm sure they all thought when they found out that Phyllis's house had taken some fire damage, they wouldn't go directly to murder.
No.
They would just think it's probably an accident.
I think that's a pretty typical response. There's no one in my life, if I found out that there was a fire in their house, that I would think it was foul play. I would just think it was an accident. So yeah, I think that response makes sense, especially because although she had quit, she was a smoker for many years. Spence, her son, whom she just spent the past couple of days with, was on his way back to his mom's house to mow her lawn when he learned of her death from Jennifer. And I already mentioned that the room was likely where the fire originated, the room she was found in, but the authorities have not disclosed if an accelerant was used. They really haven't disclosed many details about this fire at all.
I'm probably jumping ahead, but was the fire what caused her death?
No. The autopsy results determined that Phyllis died before the fire from blunt force trauma. She sustained multiple blows, specifically to the head, before the fire was started, and then her body was badly burned after the fact. Her death went from what seemed like this accidental death to a vicious homicide. You have to be very depraved to beat anyone to death, but a 74-year-old woman is extremely disturbing. This was unfathomable to her family. They did not know of anyone who had a problem with Phyllis, any enemies she had, who could want her dead and why. So it appeared the fire may have been set in an attempt to destroy evidence. And or if the killer wasn't very bright, they may have thought it would appear that Phyllis somehow accidentally started this fire and died as a result.
Could this maybe have been a robbery attempt gone wrong? Do we know if anything was stolen from the house?
As far as we know, based on what Jennifer said on behalf of her family, nothing was stolen that they could tell. With Phyllis being a collector, it is possible items were stolen and her family didn't notice because they probably didn't know every single belonging she had. But we know her highest value items were still in the home. She had a lot of nice jewelry and hundreds in cash was just left sitting in Phyllis's purse. The police haven't addressed this, but I think Phyllis's family would know better than anyone. So based on that, it does not appear that burglary was the motive in this case. Although we can't be 100% certain that it wasn't a factor here, it just does not seem probable. Somewhat related to that, I couldn't find mention of whether there were signs of forced entry to the home or if there's any theory on how the killer got inside.
Well, you mentioned that she typically doesn't lock her doors. Right. So they probably just walked in.
I don't know about overnight. We don't know when she died necessarily. We don't have that time pinpointed. I think it was more so during the day that she would leave the doors unlocked. I would imagine at night she would lock up, but maybe not. Honestly, yeah, someone could have walked in the home if she left the door unlocked and there wouldn't be signs of forced entry. Going back to the time of death, we know Spence last saw his mom around 3 p.m. on Sunday. Then she's found deceased around 7 a.m. the next day. So her time of death is considered to be between those two times. If they were able to narrow that window at all, the investigators haven't said that, but the location of her body in her bedroom could lead us to believe that she had gone to bed for the night and was killed overnight or possibly the next morning. But it could also be that the offender forced Phyllis to go into the bedroom or the attack led there from another part of the house.
Yeah, were they able to determine what she was wearing? Was she wearing the same outfit that she was that day, and Spence could identify that? Or, you know, was she wearing pajamas? But then again, they probably wouldn't be able to tell based on how much damage the fire caused, right?
Yeah, it's reported that her body was badly burned. So I'm not sure if they were able to tell what clothes she was wearing. But yeah, that would be a helpful clue if they were able to tell. And I mean, additionally, you'd think the state of the fire could help narrow down the time of death. It's hard to believe that if the neighbors saw the smoke at 7 a.m., she could have been killed the afternoon before, and the fire started a whole day before, basically. Logically, it makes more sense that Phyllis was killed overnight or even Monday morning. Phyllis lived in a quiet neighborhood where safety was rarely a concern. So news of her murder shook the community. The residents were on edge, but according to some of Phyllis's neighbors through reporting from KBOI News, they were assured by the police that the murder was not random, but rather a targeted attack. This information provided comfort to those who had been concerned about this being a random attack. We talked about this during our last episode, the police assuring people that they don't need to be that concerned because it wasn't random. But these are unsolved cases. I don't know who the Boise police had on their radar to make them reportedly say this to people in the community, but they must have felt confident that they had their suspect. And I think, keyword, I think I might know the identity of that suspect, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, it's surprising to hear them say that when the victim was an elderly, sweet woman who just enjoyed antiquing and gardening and didn't have any enemies. And, you know, if that can happen to this type of person, then it could seemingly happen to anyone, right? I get the sentiment. You don't want people to feel like they're in imminent danger, but, you know, just to give a reassurance, like make sure you lock your doors and just general things like that could go a long way rather than saying no one's in danger. Don't worry.
Right. I don't think they should cause mass panic. And it's not like I think a bunch of people were in danger, but I will say here we are almost 13 years since Phyllis's murder and the case is still unsolved. So they clearly haven't gathered enough evidence to make a truly solid case against anyone. And there was one statement from a Boise police spokeswoman that there was no evidence that there was an ongoing threat to the community after the murder, but that there was no evidence that there wasn't, which sounds like a more appropriate way to describe the situation. Basically, we don't know if there's a threat because we don't know who killed Phyllis. And if they were saying it was a targeted attack, that implies that they know who wanted to kill Phyllis. And from what we're thinking here, she sounds like someone who wouldn't have anyone in her life who would want to kill her. According to reporting from KTVB News, in the 10 years preceding Phyllis's murder, there were 37 homicides in Boise, and only three of those cases at the time of Phyllis's murder remained open, including her case. So having a 92% clearance rate when looking at the past 10 years probably gave the police confidence that Phyllis's case would not go unsolved. 92% is much better than the national clearance rate for murder, according to the FBI, of 62% in 2012. In the early days of the investigation, the police asked the community to come forward with any relevant information they might have. They did receive tips, and the Idaho Statesman reported in early August, so a few weeks after the murder, that several anonymous tips of considerable interest were provided to Crime Stoppers, and the police asked those that submitted the tips to identify themselves so the investigators could receive more information. I haven't seen this happen before in a case I've researched, so it stuck out to me. Typically, people are allowed to remain completely anonymous, so I presume they were either suspicious of the person or people who called in because of the information they provided, or the information piqued their interest, but they needed more or a way to validate it. If the people who provided tips ended up identifying themselves, that was not reported on, but I wouldn't expect it to be. Then, nearly 6 weeks after Phyllis's murder, on September 1st, 2012, someone started a fire at her unoccupied home for a second time. The offender used gasoline as an accelerant, but only succeeded in starting a small fire, although it caused a loud boom, which drew the attention of Phyllis's neighbors. The police discovered a broken window, which was evidently how the arsonist entered Phyllis's home, leaving behind traces of blood. According to reporting from the Idaho Statesman, DNA was extracted from the blood at the scene, and it was matched to a known criminal, Stephen Eugene Roberts III. His DNA was in the system from prior offenses. At the time of the fire, he had been released from prison several months before in April 2012. Stephen served time for 2006 burglary and assault and battery charges and was out on parole. By the time the police made the connection between Stephen and the DNA left at Phyllis's house, he had fled the state of Idaho. Fortunately, his parole officers successfully tracked him down in Louisiana after he used his credit card there. His arrest came about a month after the fire, and Stephen was transported back to Idaho. In 2013, 43-year-old Stephen pleaded not guilty to first-degree arson and first-degree burglary, and a bench trial was scheduled in 2014 where a judge would review the evidence presented by both sides and issue a verdict of guilty or not guilty. One report said he submitted a guilty plea initially, but then later he pleaded not guilty, so he must have changed his plea quickly since there was a trial. Stephen's story is a bit confusing because he admits to being at Phyllis's home the night of the fire. I mean, there was no way for him to get around that because his blood was left at her house. But according to the Idaho Statesman, he claimed that he was frightened by something, cut his arm while running, tripping, and then falling through a back porch window at Phyllis's home.
Could he explain why he was in such close proximity to her house for that to even have happened?
I'm sure he came up with something, but I saw no explanation for why he would be in her backyard in the first place. So he admitted to being there, but he insisted he did not start the fire. So are we just supposed to believe that he had this strange experience at her home and then someone else happened to come along and start the fire because he doesn't name anyone as being with him when this happened? A friend of Stephen's testified that he'd been drinking at a bar with him before the fire occurred. The friend stated that Stephen returned at closing time around 4 a.m., smelling of gasoline and with a cut on his arm. Stephen allegedly told his friend that he got the injury during a fight, I guess that occurred in the time he was away, while his girlfriend testified that Stephen claimed he was cut after falling into a garbage bin.
Yeah, so this guy's guilty, right? I mean, there's like 45 different stories.
Yeah. At the conclusion of the bench trial, the judge found Stephen guilty, as I'm sure we were all expecting, and sentenced him to 30 years in prison. I believe the maximum for arson was 25 years, but because he was a habitual offender, they were able to tack on 5 additional years. His defense attorney said that Stephen continued to maintain his innocence and remained hopeful that the real perpetrator would one day be found. The case against Stephen is strong. I mean, I don't think there was any doubt from the judge that Stephen was responsible for starting the second fire, but could he have been responsible for the first fire and Phyllis's murder? The short answer is no. It would be a poor decision for Stephen to return to the crime scene if he were the killer. He may not have been on their radar at all, and by starting the second fire, he drew attention to himself. But seeing as criminals like this are not known for making good decisions, it wouldn't be unheard of. The answer is no, because according to a Boise Police Department spokesperson, they can unequivocally say the second fire was not linked to the murder of Phyllis. Stephen was in custody on July 22nd and 23rd, the days she could have been killed, which ruled him out as the perpetrator of the first fire and Phyllis's murder. Stephen likely heard about Phyllis's murder in the first fire, and since her address was publicized, her family believed Stephen may have looked at the situation, knowing her house was vacant as an opportunity to burglarize the home. And with Stephen's history of burglary, this seems probable. This is a theory, though we will likely never know why he did what he did with certainty, since he maintains his innocence. Stephen later filed an appeal, but his conviction was upheld. The fire re-victimized and re-traumatized Phyllis's family. Her daughter Jennifer felt sickened to know someone was in their mom's home causing damage again. I imagine that's a very violating and unsettling feeling. The Boise police have never named a suspect or person of interest in Phyllis's murder. However, in 2015, a few years after Phyllis's death, her son Spence spoke out, revealing that he believed he was a top suspect for the police in his mom's murder. Spence served as a sailor in the Navy for about 8.5 years before leaving in 2004, around the time his third child was born. Long deployments were straining his family, prompting his decision to leave the military, although he and his wife later divorced. Over the years, Spence also battled with alcohol abuse, something that will come up again in just a moment. Spence indicated that the police set their sights on him from the outset, even claiming that they directly accused him of murdering his mom on the day she was found, presumably when they first spoke with him. They questioned him on 5 or 6 occasions, making their interest clear. Now, I don't know what evidence the police have against Spence, if any, but we can talk about why they were so focused on him and may still be, based on what he has said. Spence told the Idaho Statesman that he accidentally said he was the last person with his mom, when what he meant was that he was the last person with her before the person who killed her. They allegedly interpreted that as he was truly the last person with her.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of just seems like a semantics issue, and they were taking that and running with it.
Yeah, it seems like an easy mistake to make. I don't know how much weight this should be given, because no one else admitted to being with Phyllis after Spence left her house on Sunday, and he would have known that. So I feel like this could be an easy statement to make without actually meaning you were the last person with her. With that said, I do understand why he would draw attention from the investigators because of that very reason. Being the last known person to be with Phyllis, they have to rule him out. Spence had a criminal history that could have also interested the police. Spence was on probation when his mom was murdered after a 2007 felony DUI conviction. Of course, this ties back to his alcohol abuse. And after the DUI, Phyllis led with tough love. But at the end of the day, she was typically the one there for him to bail Spence out when others weren't. Leading up to Phyllis's murder, his life had been moving in a positive direction. He was living in a hotel temporarily, but he was hopeful about the future and planning to buy a house soon. Things were starting to look up, at least for a while, but after her murder, Spence's life unraveled once again. He admitted to basically spiraling out of control. His probation was revoked 5 months after his mom's murder, and he was sent to the St. Anthony Work Camp, a correctional facility in St. Anthony, Idaho, designed to house minimum and community custody male inmates, basically lower risk inmates. And the facility oversees various programs developed for offender rehabilitation. By the time he was interviewed about his mom's murder, he had already been released. Spence's run-ins with the law could have been a red flag for the police, despite the fact that his offenses were not violent from what I could find. I saw another DUI offense afterward in 2020 and a public intoxication offense in 2018. So alcohol seems to be the root of the issue here. I mean, with a DUI, you are certainly putting the lives of others at risk. It's very serious, but I'm talking about direct acts of violence, such as battery. I didn't find anything of that nature in his background. When you think about someone who bludgeons someone to death, it is difficult to imagine that person not having a violent history, but it is possible. And also, it goes without being said that just because someone doesn't have a documented criminal history of violence, that doesn't mean they don't have a history of violence. I'm not saying that's the case with Spence, rather that the person who killed Phyllis could be identified one day and not have a violent arrest record, yet still be a violent person.
So when Spence kind of made this public and said that the police were questioning him in his mom's murder, did anyone from his family come out and, you know, publicly defend him and say there's no way that Spence would do something like this?
I didn't see anyone from the family address the situation, which I did think was interesting. Jennifer has probably done the largest number of interviews out of the siblings, and I have not seen her address the situation with Spence saying that he was a suspect. Like, I haven't seen her defend him, but I don't necessarily take that as she thinks he's suspicious. I just thought it was a little odd. I just think if this were my sister, I'd be coming out and saying that she couldn't have been responsible.
Yeah, and I suppose unless she was directly asked about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Then she wouldn't just bring it up out of the blue.
That's true. I was just thinking because she was interviewed in the same article by the Idaho Statesman where he's coming out and saying all this. So in my mind, I was thinking they would ask her about it, but they could have spoken with her first and then talked with him and then didn't get a comment from her on that. But yeah, she hasn't addressed it. I mean, she did make a comment. She said something about how good of a mom Phyllis was and how she thinks all the kids turned out well. So I'm not going to read into it like she doesn't have a good relationship with him. I just thought it was interesting. In addition to Spence's background, some of his actions may have raised suspicion. He drank and slept in her yard the night after she was found. So Phyllis was found in the morning, and that night was when he slept in her yard. Spence explained that he thought the killer might return to Phyllis's home, and he wanted to confront this person. Whether this is suspicious behavior is subjective. It seems like an odd decision, just considering he could have slept in his car in front of the house rather than the yard. You all should let us know what you think, but I don't see this as an indication of guilt. If he is innocent and had nothing to do with his mom's murder, then we can presume he was experiencing a significant amount of distress, possibly shock, coupled with any time alcohol or drugs are involved in someone's actions. We can't always apply the same lens of logic and rationale that we would if they weren't involved.
Right. But at the same time, I find it interesting that he'd do this considering the fact that if his plan worked, he'd be confronted with a killer.
Yeah, that would be a scary situation. But I think he was just, like I said, possibly in shock, not thinking straight about everything and actually thinking that he could meet the same fate as her if this person did return. I guess I just think of it in the same vein as the comment he made about being the last one with her. I don't think it really points in any one direction. Spence told the Idaho Statesman that the police cut out chunks of the seats in his vehicle and confiscated a baseball bat stored in his car. Presumably, they were interested in the baseball bat because Phyllis died from blunt force trauma. A baseball bat could have been the weapon, but it was never connected to Phyllis's murder, and he said it was in his car because he played in a men's ball league. Spence has said that the police have no evidence against him, and without the police sharing any information, it appears that's an accurate statement. But this could be a case where the police have a lot of evidence, and that's why they're being so quiet. They don't want to ruin the investigation at all. But at this point, nearly 13 years later, maybe they could stand to share a little more than what they have so far. Spence has wondered if the police questioned other people in Phyllis's life, such as her ex-boyfriend or handyman who worked on her home, as much as they questioned him. In general, I think you'd have to look at anyone who had something to gain from Phyllis's murder, because if this is not a personal motive here, which we don't know, there could have been, you wonder who gained financially from Phyllis's death. Who were the beneficiaries of her retirement accounts or a life insurance policy, if she had one? And where was that person or where were those people during the period in which she was killed? Did they have an alibi? It could very well be that Spence was a beneficiary and he didn't have an alibi? That's what I'm interested in. What was he doing that night? If he were staying at a hotel, can he be seen on camera entering the hotel? Does he exit at any point in the middle of the night? I don't think this is actually the case, but as far as we know, they couldn't narrow down the time of death beyond 3 p.m. Sunday to 7 a.m. Monday. So that could present challenges when trying to establish an alibi for any potential suspects. So Spence has expressed frustration with the police. On the other hand, Phyllis's daughter, Jennifer, has shown trust in their investigation and has not been so critical. Spence's theory, at least in 2015, was that someone using drugs killed his mom. According to Spence, there was a party going on at a house near Phyllis's home the night of her murder. The theory that the killer was using drugs does not feel far-fetched, but there are a lot of homes in this neighborhood. So what are the odds of someone from this party getting into Phyllis's home, a home with an older woman who is alone, a vulnerable person, without trying other homes first, unless they were familiar with Phyllis? Regardless, if there were a party in Phyllis's neighborhood that night, hopefully the police were able to track everyone down and question them, as well as the other neighbors. After their mother's death, her children focused on cleaning up the fire damage and renovating the home to prepare it for sale, as it no longer felt like a comfortable space to them. A year after her murder, they hadn't fully gone through her belongings, except for a few items they knew they wouldn't hold on to. They sold 36 bins of fabric to a local quilter, feeling good that the fabric would be put to good use. They eventually sold the house and decided what to do with all of Phyllis's possessions. In 2022, in order to bring more awareness to her mom's case, Jennifer partnered with Lamar Advertising to secure a billboard in Boise that displayed information about Phyllis's murder. Phyllis sounded to me like such an interesting woman. She had a lot of interests and talents, a fun personality. Her murder is a true tragedy. When researching this case, I found myself thinking a lot about the murder of Helen McPherson, which we covered in episode 43. There are similarities between Phyllis's murder and Helen's. And of all the cases we've covered, I feel like that one has one of the best chances of being solved. But disappointingly, it hasn't reached a conclusion.
I guess my final thoughts are, you know, it's interesting how quiet the police have been. Makes me think that there is kind of a lot going on behind the scenes, and maybe maybe they have more information than they're releasing to the public.
And,
and they probably have or are building or continuing to build a case against someone.
Yeah, that's how I feel too. I hope that they're just plugging away in the background and then not updating the public, because I would say, again, looking at all the cases we've covered, this would probably be in the top five with how tight-lipped they've been. They have said hardly anything. So I just hope that means that they're building a case against someone. But at a certain point, again, it's been almost 13 years. So you start to question it after so many years.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. It's been 12, almost 13 years now. You'd think they, at some point, they would have enough to at least make some sort of statement to the public.
And they're not asking the public for help. So what does that tell us? It feels like they're not waiting on a little piece of information from someone in the public because they're not asking for it. So what are they waiting on? How are they going to solve this case?
Something that just to make sure it's airtight? I don't know.
Yeah. So if you have information related to the murder of Phyllis Ward, please contact Crime Stoppers at 208-343-2677. Or call the Boise Police directly at 208-377-6790. Thank you all so much for joining us for this case. That is all for now, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.